introduced to you yesterday afternoon was the concept of building self-confidence. And if he went true to our schedule, he was going to talk to you about who you are and approach it initially from that standpoint, and I'm sure that he did.
When we lack confidence,
it's simply a fact, we struggle. When I first began to ponder this subject, my mind went back to the book of Jeremiah, the first chapter, where Jeremiah and the Lord have this dialogue.
Then said I, Jeremiah,
O Lord God, behold, I cannot speak, for I am a child. But the Lord said unto me, Say not, I am a child, for thou shalt go to all that I shall send thee, and whatsoever I command thee, thou shalt speak.
It seems to be no coincidence that many
times we think of ourselves at various points in our life as children, inadequate, incapable, and really not up to the task the Lord seems to have laid at our feet. Now, you may call that by whatever term you want to, but I consider that to be a lack of confidence. If I understand, but even more importantly, if I believe what Paul told me and you in Philippians, the 4th chapter and the 13th verse, he told us that we can do all things through Christ that strengthens us. So the concept of confidence may, in essence, boil down to the degree to which we truly believe what the Lord has told us. And yet, the concept of self-confidence, I believe, genders up an uneasiness in most of us. It gendered up an uneasiness in my mind when Carol and Vern and I were on the phone talking about this past week. But the building of self-confidence, I believe, is an art. It's a skill. It's something that you can develop. It's something that you can cultivate. It's something that you can exercise, and it's certainly something you can get better at. The fact is, however, that very few in the family of God are good at building self-confidence. Too often we don't think about it. Too often we don't exercise it. Therefore, maybe it should come as no surprise to most of us that maybe we're not all that good at it. Few things are more debilitating than the lack of confidence. A lack of confidence in an individual can cause a vast deal of talent to go untapped. It can cause a wealth of capability to simply shrivel on the vine. It can cause a yearning spirit of a young person to halt at the gate and never enter into the service of the Lord. It's something that I believe besets both the young and the old. The young often asking themselves, Am I truly adequate to face life when I'm surrounded with other young peers of such great talent, of such great assuredness, and of such great confidence, and I'm a shriveling shell of an individual, not knowing at those tender ages that behind all of that self-confidence that we see in our peers is another shriveling shell of doubt and concerns. The more I deal with the older people and the closer I get to them, the more I deal with them. As Richard Riggins used to say, old people are people that are 20 years older than you are, and he's having more trouble all the time finding any. I think that's somewhat true for all of us as we near and begin to move into that age. But I believe one of the real burdens of age is the beginning of feelings of uselessness. What is the role that I'm to play as a senior, more mature person in the congregations that I'm devoted to? I also believe that the concept that I'd like to talk with you about for the 2 days I'm up here this week with you also overtakes us in some of the most hurting times of our lives, because when we have a lack of confidence, it's usually not when things are going well, it's when things are going poorly. When something has happened that's shaken our confidence. It's not my intent to drag up hurts. It's not my intent to drag you through the pain of things you've gone through in the past, but at the same time, I don't know really how to fully do this topic the justice that I hope to try to do without reliving some of those pains and reliving some of those hurts. We'll do the best we can with an honest assessment. My mind immediately went back to a conversation I had almost to the day 2 months ago as I was sitting in the living room of Wilford and Mary. And he said, "John, I'm supposed to talk about building self-confidence at the two-week meeting." Trying to keep the conversation going, I responded with some profound explanation like, "Oh." He then proceeded to talk a little bit more about it. And he said, "I'm just uncomfortable with this concept of self-confidence." And again, responding to him with great, profound in-depth, I said, "Oh," little knowing the turn of events that would ensue. But I do believe I understand what he was trying to get at, the concept of an uncomfortability about self-confidence. If I had left the word self out of what I wrote on the board and simply wrote up building confidence, we would be off to the races without a second thought. It's when we interject the word self that it becomes difficult. As Lee mentioned in the class just before lunch, there's a plethora of books on how to improve the self. The difficulty of most of those books is they are humanistic trash, having little to do with the actual concept of self-confidence that we find in the scriptures. And we are concerned, and we do shy away somewhat from the concept of self-confidence with good reason. For in Romans chapter 12 and verse 3, it says, "Let's not esteem ourselves more highly than we ought." In Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 18, it says, "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." And if we forget those passages, then we have forgot the essence of the gospel message. And while we teach our little kids to sing a little song called J-O-Y that says, "Jesus first, yourself last, and others in between," we don't live in a society that practices J-O-Y. We live in a society that practices yourself first, maybe then others, and by all means, Jesus last. So for me to enter into this discussion with you with any kind of comfortability, I have to make a distinction, and Tom may have made it in different words yesterday, the distinction between confidence in self and confidence of self. Because I believe when we gender up confidence in self, that's another word for pride. But when we gender up confidence of ourselves, then that is security and that is assurance. I believe there's great confusion among Christians today about the distinction between pride and confidence, but I believe there is a tremendous distinction between them. Many feel they really need to maintain a certain level of inferiority as the only safeguard against a haughty spirit and the pitfalls of self-sufficiency. But I do not believe that is the option or the trade-off that we have to take. It is true that the Bible clearly condemns pride. I can at least cite 112 places in the Bible, and I'm sure there are more, but at least 112 that I found where the Bible condemns a proud, a haughty, a self-oriented spirit. And the passage in Proverbs chapter 6, beginning with verse 6 through 9, where it says, "There are six things, yea, seven are an abomination." I think it was no accident, nor was a coincidence, that he placed at the front of that list a proud look. But I'm also convinced that the Bible does not condemn, and in fact it encourages, an attitude of, if Jim will allow me, quiet, self-respect, and dignity. Jesus commanded us to love our neighbors, how? As ourselves. And if I understand that commandment, it's telling me that without a reasonable, respectable, or sufficient level of self-love, I'm then in no position to love my fellow man. A man who doesn't love himself cannot love another. And I believe that's why you see people with chronic or acute lack of self-confidence oftentimes remaining single. And even if they go through the ceremony, they maintain a very isolated and a subservient life. Those who lack self-confidence will, in an ironic twist, be self-centered. Pride is self-centeredness, which elevates the self. Lack of confidence is self-centeredness that deflates the concept of self. And I believe the scriptures tell us that both are equally wrong. It's when we have the vision of ourselves that God has that we begin to take on the image of His Son. Biblical pride is arrogance. It's self-sufficiency. It's that which keeps the two basic commandments recorded in Matthew chapter 22, verses 37 and 38. Love the Lord thy God and love thy fellow man. It allows us to do both of those. For if you don't have self-respect and confidence in what God has made you, then you can't do them. A proud person is one who's pompous. A proud person is one who is so proud that he cannot humbly bow his knees to the Lord. And that's what the Lord tells us to stay away from. As such, pride is really at the root of most of the ills of this world. Pride is at the root of war. Pride is at the root of crime. And that's why the writer put it at the head of the list when he said, stay away from a proud look. And it is true that the quest for confidence can lead to pride, but it need not. Christian confidence is that quiet assurance that we, as a tool in the hand of God, can do any and all things that He's asked us to do. Anything less is a lack of faith. For if I read the Scriptures and then do not believe that God can take me as a tool to perform any and all things that He's asked me to do, then I don't truly believe. I don't truly have faith in what He can transform me into. Yeah, we live in a me generation that looks out for number one, that does its own thing, that has the motto of me first. But it's the concept of me first that blows relationships completely apart. And as we get into our discussion next week on the family, I'm going to dwell on this at length. A relationship that focuses on the rights rather than the responsibilities of an individual. A relationship that focuses on the I and the me rather than the you and the they is doomed to disaster. Whether it's a marriage, whether it's a parent-child relationship, whether it's a business relationship, or in the broader scope, even if it's a civilization. But the solid confidence that you and I are God's and through Him can do all things is not pride. It's right. When Christ went through and tapped some men on the shoulders, figuratively, and said, follow thou me, I believe those men had to have a great deal of self-confidence to leave those fishing nets, to leave those successful businesses, and become disciples of Christ. But the lack of confidence is not humility. The lack of confidence is a lack of faith. It's a lack of an understanding that God can, amazing as it may seem, turn us into something that we wouldn't recognize without His help. Sometimes when I'm before a group like this, I feel like I'm talking to the wrong people because we often talk about doing that which is right and avoiding that which is wrong. And at a meeting, especially at a meeting like this, as a teacher, as a speaker, you really feel like you're preaching to the choir. But today, I think this particular topic, I'm talking to exactly the right people. Because you are the people that can build confidence in the people that you associate with. You're the people that can build confidence as you go back to your home congregation. So I'm elated with at least having a topic that I believe, to the best of my ability, we're talking to the right people. How many times does the pen of the New Testament writers drip with the desire for people to be confident? Barnabas, in Acts chapter 11, verses 22 and 23, it says he went throughout the cities, and it uses an interesting word. It says he exhorted them. Well, I believe a great deal of that exhortation was toward being confident and being bold. Barnabas, you remember in Acts chapter 15 and verse 36, we find a young man, Mark, who had gone with Paul and Barnabas on their first missionary journey, and something had gone awry. Not too long after they began it, as they got back onto the firm mainland, it says John Mark departed. And you know, as they started that second missionary journey, Paul says, no, I don't think that's the young man I want to take with him. And Barnabas said, yes, I think this is a good young man. And beginning with verse 36 of that 15th chapter, we find the dialogue between Paul and Barnabas. And if Colossians chapter 4 and verse 10 is the correct read, it appears that Barnabas was right. And John Mark had a lot to to offer as he matured. But think what would have happened to John Mark, a young man, had it not been for Barnabas. That's why in Acts chapter 4, Barnabas is called the son of encouragement, the son of consolation. The scripture speaks of speaking boldly many times. John chapter 7, verse 26, it says, Christ spoke boldly, and I believe that means with confidence. In Acts chapter 9, verses 27, and again in verse 29, Paul spoke boldly. In Acts chapter 18, verse 26, Apollos spoke boldly. And what was it that Paul asked the Ephesian brethren to pray for him in Ephesians chapter 6, verses 19 and 20, after he had listed the armor that they were to put on? And he says, And for me, that utterance may be given unto me, that I may open my mouth and speak boldly. But it doesn't end there. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 16, you and I are told to come boldly to the throne of God. Confidence is essential. With the remainder of the time that I have today, I'm going to try to now move from the concept of self-confidence to the concept of building self-confidence, because that's really what I've been asked to address. And I believe that one of the keys to building self-confidence is the art of encouragement. Encouragement is an interesting word. In the King James, it's found nowhere in the New Testament and only a handful of times in the Old Testament. But I believe that its meaning is strongly implanted in the Scriptures of the New Testament and therefore needs to be strongly implanted in our hearts. And under the heading of building self-confidence, I believe there are two types of encouragement. Encouragement we get from one another and encouragement that we get from God. I'm going to deal with the first one first because I believe it's really a subsection of the latter, and then Thursday we'll deal in more detail with the confidence we get from God. But encouraging one another is a most important function. You remember what the father did when the prodigal son came back? He had a great feast. Why do you think he had a great feast? Well, I think one reason was he was joyous. But I believe, in all likelihood, another reason was to encourage that young man to that which he had returned. Encouraging one another is a delicate thing to do because we worry about not doing enough of it and discouraging one another, and we worry about doing too much of it and ruining an otherwise good individual. It's been said that man is a unique animal. He's the only animal God created that when you pat him on the back, his head gets bigger. And I believe there's some truth to that we have to be somewhat conscious of. Yet man has a great need to have his confidence built through encouragement. And the greater the task, the greater the need for encouragement. And what greater task is there than living the Christian life? I don't care how influential you are. I don't care how secure you appear. I don't care how mature you are. Genuine encouragement always helps. We all have an insatiable need for it. Most of us need massive doses, if the truth be known, as we struggle in the trenches. But often we're too proud to admit it. And that which we're afraid of creating, pride, becomes that which keeps us from the needed tonic of encouragement. Unfortunately, this type of pride is often too prevalent in the family of God, just like it is in the world. In Philippians chapter 1, verses 3 through 6, Paul there exhorts them. He says, I pray for you. That wasn't simply a statement of fact. That was a statement of encouragement to build their confidence. One of the highest human duties and one of the most productive human duties is building self-confidence in our brothers and in our sisters. It's easy to pour cold water and discourage people. And for some, that may even be fun. But it's not what's needed. It's the building up of our confidence one in another. Many times the only thing keeping a brother and sister in your home congregation on their feet is a word of praise, a pat on the back, a word of appreciation, or a smile and a moment of cheer. And one of the great things about building self-confidence in one another, we can all do it. I've yet to meet a man or a woman who can't encourage. I've met a lot who don't. I've met a lot who won't. But I've not yet met one that I'm convinced can't. Because you don't have to stand up in the pulpit to build self-confidence. In fact, you probably do it better when you do it one-on-one. Some of the most great, some of the most gracious, some of the most effective builders of self-confidence are our sisters, who seem to know better than we men the right time to pat on the back, to smile, and to give that boost to someone that needs it. Mountain climbing is not anything that I aspire to. In fact, it's something that I have a great aversion to. Pleasant Hill is as high as I really ever care to get. But I've watched mountain climbers for years on TV. And you ever notice how they always have a rope tied to tie them together? Well, for a long time, I bought into this theory that that was a safety gimmick. But I believe, as one man finally got me to see, that that's to keep the sane ones from going home. That's why they tie mountain climbers together. It's not safety. It's to keep someone who comes to his senses from going home. But I would subscribe to you there may be a second reason, and that's to encourage. Because when we do things in a group, when you're fastened to someone else and you have some goal of keeping up to their pace, it encourages you. That's why in the book of Acts we saw brethren going out in groups. Brethren as strong as Paul always went, it seems, with a group. I believe it was no accident that God set into his great plan the ecclesia, the assembly, the church, which in Hebrews chapter 10, verses 24 and 25 tells us to consider one another and to provoke one another and to love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another so much the more as you see the day approaching. Your lips can almost move with mine as we quote that. But that passage tells me the ecclesia, the group, is to provoke, to encourage one another and to build up our confidence. God has always wanted his people to come together. He's always wanted them to assemble. In the patriarchal age, it would be assembling around the patriarch of that family. Under the Mosaical age, it would be assembling around the tabernacle. You remember when they camped, what was in the middle? And they encircled it. I believe that was largely to keep those people together. Keep them, one, focused on God, and two, in close proximity one with another. When he set up the feast, he made three feasts, which every year he asked the Jewish men to come back, if they at all could, and be assembled. The Passover, the Pentecost, and the Feast of the Tabernacles. To keep people together, because he knows that encouragement and the building of self-confidence is so important. It's a great job of the church, of the family, to build confidence in one another. As was alluded to this morning, the church is not a country club for the spiritually affluent. It's a hospital for the spiritually hurting. And to the extent we get that concept through, I believe will be the extent that we have control of our evangelistic efforts. But when we give praise one to another, it's fraught with dangers. Because building confidence is like rolling a rock to the top of the pinnacle. You want to get it as close to the top as you can, knowing that if you go too far, it will begin tumbling over the other side and do more damage than you had intended. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 15 says that a focal point of our worship is to offer the sacrifice of praise, that being to God. And I believe maybe it's because of our focal point of praising God that we sometimes back off praising one another. Because of the concerns that we have with Romans 12:3 and Proverbs 16 and 18 that I alluded to earlier in my remarks to you. And since praise is central to our worship, we often reserve it for God. And we avoid giving it one to another. But I believe there is a strong place for praise and encouragement as we interact one with another. What do you want to hear in the judgment day from the Lord? Well done. Now, how are you going to react when you hear those words? Are you going to slough that off? Or are you going to accept that as welcome to praise from God? I can't see any of us, if when we hear, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant," scuffing our foot in the ground and saying, "Oh, shucks, it wasn't anything." We're going to receive that with joy. And we have every right to accept godly praise, whether it comes from God or it's sent through our brothers and sisters with great joy. Now understand, there is a difference between seeking praise and accepting praise. The Scriptures warn us about seeking praise, doing things for the eye service of men in Ephesians 6 and 6. Loving the praise of men more than the praise of God in John 12:43. And I full well know that we are somewhat walking a tightrope here, but I believe it's a tightrope that's well worth walking. If you'd like to, and I'd like for you to, if you've got your Bibles, I'd like for you to go to Proverbs, the 31st chapter. You ladies know what this says, and maybe a few of us men do. Proverbs 31st chapter is commonly called the virtuous wife. But in Proverbs 31, I want to look at two verses, verse 28 and then verse 31. Her children arise up and call her blessed. Oh, what a musical, melodious sound that would be to any mother. To be called blessed by her children because they believe it and not because Hallmark tells them that it's that time of year. Her husband also, he praiseth her. Men, women like to be praised. They like it better than flowers. They like it better than candy. So if you haven't, underline that. Drop down to verse 31. Give her of the fruit of her hands and let her own works praise her in the gates. It is not only acceptable for a godly woman to accept praise, it is a commandment that we praise her for what she does and that we praise her for her works. Now flip over to Acts chapter 9 and verse 39. A little more subtle admonition, but I don't think any less important. The death of a godly woman. We sometimes call Tabitha or Dorcas. But look in verse 39. Peter arose and went with them. Now this lady had died, and he was going to the assembly that was surrounding her death. And when he was come, he brought them into the upper chamber, and all the widows stood by him weeping and showing the coats and garments which Dorcas made while she was with them. The people that Dorcas had helped through her life. Apparently she was a lady that had a skill in making garments. And apparently she gave them to people that were in need. These people came upon the event of her death and praised her. Rightfully so. Romans chapter 13 and verse 3, it says, one of the things that the civil government's going to do is to give praise to those in which it is appropriate. Paul in Philippians chapter 2, verses 19 and 20 says, I'm going to send Timothy to you because he's a man that I have a tremendous amount of confidence in. Now, wouldn't that be an encouragement to be a man that Paul said, I'm going to send Dave to you because I've got confidence in him? Wouldn't that be an encouragement? Wouldn't that build self-confidence? I belabor this point to try to get us over what I think is a spiritual hurdle of being embarrassed about accepting encouragement and praise. And please right now don't ask me to necessarily practice what I preach, because it's a spiritual hurdle for me. Because I do not often know how to accept praise and encouragement. I find it sometimes embarrassing, and will do most things in my power to change the subject. And I suspect some of you are also the same way. Elaborate God gave us all talents, and many of us use them well. And when brothers and sisters in your congregation use their talents well, tell them so. Tell them so consistently. Tell them so sincerely. And tell them so with the motive of encouragement. And when someone praises you, accept it. Let them praise you, because God's commanded for them to do it. Maybe a simple thank you is all it takes. But let me urge you to go a step further. When someone praises you, look at who's doing it and ask you, why did they praise me? What's in their character? What's in their talents that caused them to recognize? Acknowledge to that person that that's a valuable input to you. But there's some side benefits of praise, and I'll just insert this very briefly. I believe when we praise one another, we're also telling one another what our talents are. Many times young people will ask me, how do I know what my talent is? Well, I have only two real words of admonition. Number one, study the scriptures so you know what your options are. And secondly, listen to your brethren, because I believe most times our brethren tell us what our talents are. And they tell us what our talents are by when they come up and encourage us for a specific thing we've done. The difficulty with this is oftentimes what they're telling us isn't what we want to hear. And we have in our mind that our talent is to do this, the encouragement is coming over here, and it's a dysfunction, and we never get them into the focus. I grew up with a man that was several years older than me who isn't here, and I don't think hardly any of you know, but he was convinced his talent was to lead singing. And it was, if you wanted to end four octaves below where we started. It just wasn't his talent. And it was a very difficult thing for the brethren to do. And we kind of smile, but in your congregation and in my congregation, there are many times when people are aspiring to a talent that isn't really theirs. Then what do you do? And still build their self-confidence. If you don't care about their confidence, I got an easy answer for you. Tell them they're no good. But that doesn't do a lot for building their self-confidence. Praise is an extremely powerful force. It can turn people's lives completely around. It can motivate. It can also destroy. Those of you that I'll put in the adult age bracket, and that's just about everybody here, encourage the young. Those of you men who participate in the public service, I know for some of you it's been decades, but try to remember how terrifying those first few moments in front of the congregation were. First time I ever led a song, I announced the wrong number. Totally, I mean, you couldn't crawl under this fast enough. But I had an elder come to me after that, and he said, John, that probably didn't feel good. And I said, well, there's a perceptive individual. But he said then, I decided early in my life, and this man was 40 years older, he said, if I had to crawl up there on my hands and knees, I'd do it because I want to serve the Lord. And that made it get a lot easier for me the next time. Encourage the young people. But encourage the older people. And we all have people that are older than us. Older people sometimes get into this mindset of, I'm no longer useful. I frequently get together with an elderly gentleman in his 80s when I'm home. And we just can't get 3 minutes into the discussion or the Bible study with him without him going through this. I just feel useless. I feel like I have no place. I feel like God's family can't use me anymore. That man needs to be built up. Do all the people in your congregation feel important? They should. If you're a leader of your congregation and all of your flock doesn't feel important, you've not yet led to your fullest potential. And you can make people feel confident in such subtle ways. Ask them their opinion. The young people in our congregation really like to be asked their opinion. And we like to ask them. Because number one, we get some good inputs. But number two, we're telling them we value their input, therefore they are important, therefore their confidence is borne out by our actions and not by our words. Telling people they're important is nice, but it's dangerous. Show them that they're important. Legitimate praise has been called the food that nurtures virtue and the strength for times of sin. Encouragement, the building of confidence, is that which takes the sting out of life. It makes the unbearable bearable. I was worried if I'd have enough material to fill the first session. That's no longer a concern. Let me go just a couple of minutes and I'm going to stop and see if you have any comments or questions. The ability to encourage, I believe, is first developed in the home. Children learn how to encourage or discourage other people by being encouraged or discouraged by their parents. It's those first words of praise and jubilation that they hear from mother and dad's mouth when they do something right that teaches them how to encourage. Or it's those first haunting words of, "Can't you do anything right?" that teaches them to how to be a perpetual discourager. And the true fact is that most American homes are discouraging and not encouraging. They're deflating and not inflating. And no wonder many of our congregations follow suit. When we lose or when we lack confidence, we lose perspective. Remember Peter walking on the water? I believe he lost his confidence. He lost his focus. He lost his perspective and he began to sink. When we have a lack of confidence, little things become mammoth, like the small pebble in a shoe. That when you take your shoe off and dump it out, you say, "Is that all it was?" But it hurt as a boulder. Motivation is drained away, and desire is squelched. I've got some other points I'd like to make, but we've got about 10 minutes or so. So let me pause, and if anyone has a comment or something they'd like to add so far to this concept of building self-confidence, we'll entertain it. Margaret?
I just wanted to say sometimes the ones that we feel need the least encouragement need it the most.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I told this to the young people downstairs, and then I made them promise they wouldn't all do it today because they'd know I set you up. But I said, when you go home, tell your elders how much you appreciate the environment they've given you to grow up in the Lord. Eldership is a lonely place. And that sunk in. They understood what I was saying. That's very good. Sometimes the veneer hides the great lack of self-confidence. Excellent point. Anybody else? Lowell?
Sometimes people want to credit certain behavior that we've already talked about in this meeting to genetics. A small percentage of this is genetics. Most of it's environment. Comment on that? Or?
I'll make a comment on that, and then I'll defer to someone who may be a little more schooled in this. I believe, for me, it's a combination of both, because I think some people are simply more reserved and a little bit more insecure. But I think your environment can do a great deal toward it. And I think with that, in addition to the family of God, we can all reach a level of self-confidence in which we can be productive servants of the Lord. I think it's like many, many things. Some people battle it harder than others, but it can be overcome, just like many people battle pride more than others, maybe. Does anybody have a comment on that? I just get a little bit nervous when we put too much into genetics, and I don't say that genetics has nothing to do with it, but sometimes that's the crutch on which behavior is justified, and I want to be careful that we don't do that. Jim?
This is pretty closely related to self-concept, how you see yourself, mm-hmm. And that's about 90-10, according to most sociologists. 90% environmental, about 10% genetic.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing would be true here.
Okay. That's a good point. You got one here, Lowell. Joyce.
I've got a little saying in the back of my Bible that helps me. It says, criticism, like rain, should be gentle enough to nourish a man's growth without destroying his roots.
Okay, that's a good point. I heard one man talking and describing us as the salt of the earth. Salt comes out in a salt shaker. You don't pour it on with a bucket. You have to spread it judiciously around to get just the right amount at just the right time to be most effective. Yeah.
I think also when it comes to building self-confidence in others, you have to have a lot of patience with them and not push them.
Sure. Sure. You know, there's a flip side to this, too, and I want to mention it. I do this, too. We always think of us building self-confidence in others. Remember, there's times when the self-confidence, we need the encouragement. Be a gracious receiver and not simply a gracious giver. Mary?
Since I have a lot to do with care centers and old elderly people who I guess I love more than anybody in the world is old people, they're the ones that need their self-confidence built. People are so worried about the young that they forget the old.
Okay.
I know so.
Okay. I think that's an excellent point. But there's needs all throughout the age spectrum, but it's easy to forget them, especially in this society. That's a whole other subject, but we do our elderly such injustice sometimes. Lee?
Sometimes people look at me a little strange when I bring this up, but I think in the book of Revelation where the church at Smyrna is being referred to as thinking they were poor, but they were really rich, that this is really the key that's being talked about there. I don't think he's talking about material things at all. I think he's talking about a group of people, and I think it applies to us as well today as members of the church. We don't realize the value that we have, and so often we consider ourselves to be so poor and so worthless that we don't understand the value and the wealth that is there. And God wants us to know that that wealth is there. And it's really sinful when we continually put ourselves down, humiliate ourselves rather than being humble. And there's a difference.
Sure, there absolutely is. Enforced inferiority is not humility. Not at all. Not at all. In fact, I don't think you can be really humble without being very self-confident. I think they go hand in hand. Anybody else? Okay, just a couple of more comments that I'd like to make. You can just make a note. It's kind of a humorous little thing. Job chapter 16, verses 1 through 3. There is such a thing as miserable encouragers. And Job had three of them. And let me just point out one of the attributes that I think made them miserable. They came and preached to him. Sometimes when you're trying to instill self-confidence, you simply need to be there and you simply need to listen. Had a question come up yesterday in the class downstairs. A young man raised his hand. I won't give you too many details. I don't particularly want you to know who he is unless he wants to. But he said recently he had performed a public function in their assembly. And he said, I just did terrible. El stinko was the word we used downstairs. And he said, someone came up after that and told him what a good job he did. And he said, I felt worse after that than before. You've got to be sincere. That young man knew that he was not on his game that time. Well, my admonition to him was twofold. Number one, sometimes we think we do worse than we do. And conversely, sometimes we think we do better than we do. There's been many times in anyone that delivers any kind of public function, you're standing up here and about two-thirds of the way through it, you think, boy, this is just not going well, and how quick can we get down through the invitation? And many times that has touched someone more than when you think it's going just perfect. But that young man was saying, don't just tell me or praise me unless it's real. These young people understand and old people understand when they're being patronized. Do not do that. Then they asked me, what would I have said to that young man? What would you have said to that young man after services when he didn't do a good job? Well, I won't put you on the spot. What I told him that I would have probably done is not to have told him he did well when he didn't, because that's a lie. And our speech is to be honest. But I would have probably made it a point to have spoken to that young man, befriended him, made sure that he knew I cared for him, and maybe never brought up that particular aspect of performance at that time. Sometimes people just need a friend. They need to know that just because their performance wasn't at the level they wanted at that time or you would have liked for it to be in, you still love them, you still care about them, and that instills self-confidence in them. But it's not like the friends of Job who went there and said, "Now let me explain to you where you've messed up, Job." And he says, "Oh, you guys are miserable encouragers." And he was right. Okay, next time that I'm back up here, we're going to deal a little bit more with this, but I'm going to focus it then onto the concept of how God encourages us. And I think how we encourage one another is one of the ways God encourages us, because he's the one that gave us our brothers and sisters. But I believe he does some things for us that we're not able to do one for another in our building of our self-confidence. Okay, you have 12 minutes this time.
Did you ring the bell?